international stairs. I'm very excited to teach this material to you. I feel like especially rabbis will get what I'm talking about, so I'm very excited to see how you take it, to the direction in which you take it. Okay. So the first thing that we are going to do is we are going to hear a story. We're going to hear a story that we've actually heard many, many, many times before. But this time, we're going to listen to it in a different way and really use our imaginations and also really use our empathy. Right? I want you to hear the story through the lens of how it was for the Egyptians. Okay, so usually, we sort of start the process of the Exodus with, we're going to start with Shemot. But if you look at the beginning of Shemot, it says Ve'ela, and these are the names. We know rabbinically that whenever there's a vav at the beginning of Ela, these, it means that we're continuing the story. So even Shemot itself is signaling to you, you have to start this story a little bit earlier. So what we are going to do is we are going to sink ourselves into the end of Sefer Bereshit, when Yosef and his brothers first come down to Egypt. I'm going to read the story to you, and I want you to listen to it as much as possible with sort of fresh ears, and more importantly, with a sympathetic and an open heart. Okay? So we're at the first page. Oh, and just ahead of time, I realize that there's one more verse in the Hebrew than there is in the English. I'm going to be reading in the English. Just people can follow along whatever language is most comfortable for them. And I will just extemporaneously translate the last verse. We'll see how that goes. Okay. Yosef settled his father and his brothers and granted them a holding in the land of Egypt, in the best part of the land, in the land of Ramses, as Paro had instructed. And Yosef provided his father, his brothers, and all his father's household with food, according to the number of their dependents. Now, there was no food in all the land, for the famine was very severe. The land of Egypt and the land of Canaan languished because of the famine. Yosef collected all the money to be found in the land of Egypt and in the land of Canaan in exchange for the grain that they bought. And Yosef brought the money into Paro's house. When the money from the land of Egypt and from the land of Canaan was spent, all the Egyptians came to Yosef and said, "Give us food. Why should we die before your eyes? For our money is gone." And Yosef answered, "Give me your livestock, and I will give you food in exchange for your livestock if your money is gone." So they brought their livestock to Yosef. And Yosef gave them food in exchange for the horses, the flocks, the herds, and the donkeys. That year, he supplied them with food in exchange for all their livestock. When that year was ended, they came to him the following year and said to him, "We cannot hide from my lord that our money is all spent, and the herds of cattle are my lord's. There is nothing left in the sight of my lord but our bodies and our lands. Shall we die before your eyes, both we and our land? Buy us and our land in exchange for food. We with our land will become slaves to Paro. Just give us seed, so that we may live and not die, and that the land may not become desolate." So Yosef bought all the land of Egypt for Paro. All the Egyptians sold their fields, because the famine was severe upon them, and the land became Paro's. As for the people, he made slaves of them, from one end of Egypt to the other. Only the land of the priests he did not buy, for the priests had a fixed allowance from Paro and lived on the allowance that Paro gave him. Therefore, they did not sell their land. Then Yosef said to the people, "Now that I have this day bought you and your land for Paro, here is seed for you, sow the land. And at harvest, you should give 1/5 to Paro, and 4/5 shall be your own, as seed for the field, and as food for yourselves and your households, and as food for your little ones." They said, "You have saved our lives. May it please my lord. we will be slaves to Paro. So Yosef made it a statute concerning the land of Egypt, and it stands to this day, that Paro should have the fifth. The land of the priests alone did not become Paro's. But Israel settled in the land of Egypt, in Goshen, and they took hold of it, and they were fruitful, and they multiplied excessively. We're going to pause here. I have two questions that I want. I have two questions that I want you to answer. The first question, and we'll just go in this order. The first question is, at the conclusion here, how do you think the Egyptians feel about Yosef? And the second question is, how do the Egyptians feel about Yosef's family and their project? Okay. So we are going to start with question number one. How do you think the Egyptians feel about Yosef at this moment? Yes, David.
Exploited for everything that they had so that they could survive.
Okay.
They had nothing left. They had no food, and he made an agreement and took everything that they had and any agency they had for being independent and left them with nothing except food.
Great. So they feel totally exploited.
Totally exploited.
They were desperate, they were starving, and now they're slaves.
Yeah, and basically, and slavery, as we know, is the antithesis of what it means to be human. That you to own another person is to take away everything that they have and completely devalue their being.
Okay, so you're saying they feel exploited and they also feel maybe dehumanized.
They are dehumanized, yeah, in my opinion.
Okay. Yes, how do they feel about Yosef?
I wanted to do that.
Well, I definitely see that, and the word slavery is there, but it's really more like indentured servitude. Slaveries usually don't get 80% of their crop sales, which is what this says, or 80% of profits, or however you read it. So they may not feel that horrible. I mean, they probably don't like it. I mean, I'll agree with that, but I don't know if it's so dehumanizing, because it's really more like an indentured servitude kind of thing. You know, we would just call that a loan almost,
okay,
you know, or something like that.
Good. So I want to split sort of two components of what you're saying. One is that there's a way to assess what Yosef did as being not quite so bad or maybe even favorable for the Egyptians. Mm-hmm. But that question is important. And that question also can be separated from the question of how do the Egyptians feel about Yosef, right? So it could very well be that he saved their lives and he had no other way of doing it. And they could feel exploited by him and resentful of him. So I appreciate that your comment can actually be taken in two ways. One is, because what he did for them wasn't so bad, they therefore don't have as much antipathy towards him. And also it could be, from our perspective as readers, we can sort of see that what he did wasn't so bad, and that might not affect, right, the level of antipathy that the Egyptians might have towards Yosef. Yes.
Just in terms of the language, it doesn't seem like they're resentful. It doesn't seem like they're angry. They don't use words like cruel. And what's interesting is that they seem to be speaking directly to Yosef as the one in charge, but Yosef keeps saying, well, it's really for Paro. So maybe Yosef feels like they're angry at him, and he's trying to blame Paro, but they see it as the decision maker.
Okay, so you've just brought up a lot of things. Let's try to separate them. So the first thing that Adam noticed, which is extremely important, is that even though I was trying to read this story with as much, you know, emotion as I could muster, there are no emotion words used in the description. And there aren't even really like evaluative words like the Egyptians thought this was bad, the Egyptians thought it was good. So when I'm reading it, kind of like emphasizing their desperation, I'm trying to get you to get a sense of how the Egyptians might feel. But it doesn't seem like the text either has a particular view of how the Egyptians feel, or maybe like more harshly doesn't care about how the Egyptians feel. And Adam's also pointing out another, I think it might even be a critique of my question, which is there's also a question of how does Yosef interpret how they're feeling, and how does that in turn determine how he relates to them? And also this critical component of Yosef is either accurately or inaccurately saying or doing everything that he is saying or doing for Pharaoh. Right? It's not clear that Yosef himself is being enriched. It's also not clear if this is all Yosef's idea. The text makes sure to continue to repeat, it became Pharaoh's, he did this for Pharaoh, it will go to Pharaoh. And again, that insight, which I think is extremely important, also cuts the same way, right? Where you could view it as, oh, they know that Yosef is doing this for Paro, so what, however they feel is kind of split hazy-wazy, right, with Yosef and Paro, or you could say that there's actually either that makes no difference, or it makes them even more frustrated, because here's this guy, Paro's stooge, he's not even willing to take responsibility for what he's doing, either for us or to us.
Good.
Yes.
I guess I also wonder, the end when they say they became slaves, like they lost everything, like how their feeling was all one way. Like they're losing little by little by little by little to the end they were slaves. And I wonder if they felt like slaves at the very beginning, you know, when they just immediately had to give, just became more and more severe. And who they blamed for that, again, what you were saying, whether it was, whether they were conscious that Yosef was doing this, and he wasn't the total person in charge. He was doing it, he had a job that he was doing, because ultimately they weren't beholden to Joseph, they were beholden to Pharaoh.
Good.
So
you're pointing out, I think, two things that are extremely important. One is that there's a gradualness here that's happening on the part of the condition of the Egyptians. And that gradualness can definitely affect the way people feel. You sort of could get lulled into, and then you wake up one morning and you're like, wait, am I an indentured slave? Like, how did this happen to me that I'm giving away 20% of my labor and I also don't have any land? Like, we don't know at what point. And probably people became conscious, right, of what's happening to them at different points in the sort of evolution of this story. And also, and I want to get to, you know, David's insight about exploitation and your, you know, sort of moving us to see the gradualness of this. And the question of agency doesn't stop with Yosef and Paro. The question of agency actually stops with the Egyptians themselves, because they're the ones who present themselves to Yosef and say, we're desperate, right? And there's actually a shift between the livestock piece. Yosef's like, you don't have any money? Great, give me your livestock. But when they run out of livestock, they say to Yosef, make us slaves. Right, and sort of that, the fact that it was kind of their suggestion, if not their idea, for me totally changes the emotional picture. Because it makes the feelings much more complex. Because you're blaming Yosef, but you're also blaming yourself, and you're blaming Yosef for the fact that you're blaming yourself, and there's so much going on here. It's not just good guys, bad guys. You really can't tell where the money's going. You really can't tell where the ideas are coming from. And the gradualness and the desperation of it is all intertwined. Good, yes.
Yeah, I mean, I totally see gratitude in this, especially in verse 25. Vayomer, they say to Yosef, you know, Hechayatana, you've saved our lives. Like you, that we're like, we're so thankful for that. And if you find favor, Vehayinu Abadim LeParo. Like we'll be, you know, and what's really amazing about this is that it's setting up a scenario that actually mirrors how the Israelites live under God, right? Pharaoh takes the place of God in this story, right? But like ultimately, when we have the temple, we give a tithe to the temple. The priests don't have to pay it; they have their own portion. It's exactly mirroring the way that the Israelites live in the land of Israel.
Good, right? And there's even a rabbinic tradition that the Levites were never enslaved, right? That the same way that Paro had respect for his priestly class. Also, somehow that made its way to having respect for our soon-to-be priestly class, that the Levites themselves never became slaves.
Yeah.
So I think there is this sense of mirroring. But I just want to really validate this reading. There's one way to read this, especially if you're not like privy to my melodrama when I'm reading the story, of just like, Yosef, what a guy. We would have died without Yosef. Right? And again, that is true, and also could cut either way on the feelings piece. Right? Paro, if we're not asking the question about how the Egyptians feel about Yosef, and we were asked the question, how does Paro feel about Yosef? The answer is, Yosef He's amazing, right? He comes up with this incredible system of taxation. He saved my people from slavery. He's taking the hit. He's the face of this, you know, really, literally taxing policy. And so there's like, I think there really is a genuine way of reading Yosef as being a hero here. And I also, here's the kicker, I think that also cuts both ways, right? Because when you are dependent on someone, the feelings are never clean. You're never like, oh, I'm so grateful that I'm 100% dependent on you. Dependence and resentment, they're friends, right? So the more they realize they have no choice but to give up their bodies to Yosef, even if they're grateful and even if they intellectually realize, what a guy, he's so smart. And you know, if it weren't for him, we would all languish, no matter how much they know that intellectually, I think it would actually feed into, right, perhaps,
just I'm struck in verse 26, both that Yosef makes a folk Ad Hayom Hazeh. So I'm struck that he is able to legislate in the Egyptian system, and I feel like that might come into play in terms of how they feel about him, that he's an outsider who is able to play enough on the inside, and that he's not just creating a system and creating a solution for this particular famine in this particular historical moment. He sets up the law that continues on well past this crisis. So, and both of those feel stronger to me because he is not of them. And he has a lasting consequence of their lives.
Good. I'm going to take your rating of the foreignness piece to shift the conversation a little bit. You could still talk about Yosef, but now I really want to talk about, okay, there's Yosef himself, who is our savior. We might hate him, we might think he's a student of Paro, we might have all these other feelings about it, but like fundamentally he saved my life. Now I'm a slave, so my life is, you know, not quite as good. I used to be a landowner, now I've got nothing. So like even all of that aside, Yosef fundamentally is someone who saved my life. How do I feel about Yosef's brothers and Yosef's extended family, Mupim and Chupim and all the people that are hanging out in Egypt? How do I, as an Egyptian, feel about Yosef's extended family? You've been very patient.
So yes. This is income inequality by nepotism. Yeah. Right? Even before the intensity of the famine kicks in the later Pesukim, at the very beginning, right, you know, they get exurbia, and you know, and the Egyptians are going to be left with everything else. And I was really struck by the translation in verse 21. As for the
NRSV
people, he made
translation. I take no responsibility.
Okay, but I'm really curious because he made slaves of them. Hevir otam le'arim, like he made urbanites of them, maybe, but. So, but is that meant to be in contrast to Meitav Haaretz earlier on in the passage?
Yeah, well, I agree with you. I think there's something definitely going on here with the moving people off their ancestral lands piece that I think is actually, in some ways, what's most painful to the Egyptians, and what would, if there is an insider-outsider immigrant, you know, issue here, would definitely be what raises it. You came in as guests, you did not own any land, everything that you have we provided for you, and like at first, you're ex-Serbian, right? I really like that term, never heard before, ex-Serbia, you said?
Yeah.
Yeah, okay.
Beyond.
Yeah, okay, well, I mean, I figured out what it meant in context, but never heard it before, thank you. Right, at the beginning, it seems like Yosef and his brothers are sort of, they're fine. Like, they live in Goshen, which is like, great, but also like they're not really central, they're kind of removed. They're shepherds, which the Egyptians are not lining up to be shepherds. But then as the Egyptians' own condition gets worse and worse, and as they also don't have, you know, access the same way to their own ancestral lands, then the way that Yosef and his clan are living by comparison becomes much better, right? They seem to be living large because, yeah, they don't have their own land, but they also don't have to work the land and give the money to Paro, right? So there's something I think very important about that piece where there's also a gradualness there. Yosef's just bringing his family, of course he's going to support his family, but then as the family gets larger, and they're still in the same tax bracket, whereas the Egyptians keep on going lower, 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 then I think, you know, some tension could definitely rise. Yes.
So I'm just thinking about Jews in World War II. People often say, you know, how did you allow yourself to? Well, first they took the radios, then they took the bikes, then they couldn't go in the park, then they couldn't go in the streetcar. Like, it's a lulling. And then the other thing that I just thought now was for Germans, you know, the Jews were like 1% of Germany, but they were very visible. They were the other big shopkeepers, etc. So, well, that's all terrible.
Good. I'm also glad that you brought up the image of visible. This is a really, I think, it's amazing Rashi about Al-Pnei Ha'aretz, that the famine was on the face of the land. And he says, who was the face of the land? That's the rich people. Right, so you know that the famine was really bad because it even affected the upper stratum of society. When the rich people are lining up for bread, then you know you have a problem. Right, so there is this case of like who's more or less visible. So you could do another play on Al Pnei Ha'aretz. Maybe Pnei Ha'aretz would be Yosef and his family, who are mitzuyanim sham, right? Who are sort of distinguished there according to the Haggadah. Yeah, great. Yes,
yeah, I'm sorry. So. It's been a while since I've looked at this text, but as I recall, as this is about from one end of on verse 21, from one end of the land to the other, that either Rashi or some of the other commentators say that what he actually did is not only take their land, but then he moved them around kind of Mao Zedong style, so that their families were all disrupted. It's pretty hard, if you buy that midrash, it's pretty hard to have a good Joseph out of this, right? It's one thing, a debtor servant, okay, but as soon as you start taking everyone's land and disrupting all of the family structures, moving them to the other end of the country, and break down all bonds, there's more going on than just economics.
Right, right, and this dispossession that's so total. Yeah, beautiful. Yes.
So I guess this is kind of going back and playing with ideas we already have, but for me, in terms of how they feel, a lot of it hinges on how you read verse 19, and when they do make the suggestion, like, is it genuine, right? Are they suggesting this as, like, we want to be saved and therefore, like, thank you, we would have such gratitude? Or if we, for a minute, didn't read this as the Egyptians and we read it as the Israelites, this would be dripping in sarcasm. It would be dripping in the complaint, like, what, you're going to bring us to this point? Like, you've had us do, you know, give up our livestock, give up this, what's next? We're going to give up our land and become slaves to you, right? Like, you can just kind of, how we read this, because there's no emotional notes, really, I think, impacts how they feel about Joseph, how they feel about Joseph's family. Is it a genuine suggestion, or is this almost a sarcastic suggestion because they recognize there's nothing else, and Joseph takes it, it's like, wait, seriously? Of course we didn't mean that. Like, the emphasis is like, how can you just sit here and watch us die?
Yeah, and I think that also, you don't have to read it forward, you could read it backwards. One thing they know about Joseph is he started out as a slave. And so maybe when they say to him, we've got nothing, right? All we can be at this point is slaves, they think, that's the point when Yosef's going to say, okay, welfare state, right? I don't want you to be slaves. Now that you're all out of money, now that you're all out of livestock, now's the time when I start giving to you sort of free of charge until you get back on your feet. But Yosef doesn't sort of read it as an absurd possibility. He reads it as a great idea. So, yeah, I agree. There's a lot of irony and a lot of deliberate blindness, maybe. Yes.
Well, and since you mentioned the welfare state, one thing that's been puzzling me reading this the whole time is that when Joseph was collecting the grain in the first place, who was he collecting it from?
Right.
It's almost like, and I've just seen so many parallels, and I'm really trying not to get political about this, but it's like,
part of this year is about people being political in their heads.
You're
like,
right.
That's part of what I'm going for.
Yeah,
I'm not saying anything.
So just
you guys
for example, it would be like paying into Social Security your entire life and then having people complain about you getting an entitlement when it's, we all paid into this. Like, I don't understand why they don't have food and they don't have money, because they put away money, or they put away the food so that it would be rationed.
Yeah.
And now it's not being rationed, and it's almost like, oh, well, now I have all the food. Like, I don't understand why they're not rioting and saying, we gave you this food so that we would be safe. Like, I don't understand why that's not happening.
Great. I got nothing to add to that. Yes.
But it's not really clear to me what was happening with Joseph's family. Like, was he, in the beginning it says that he gave them a holding, which sounds like land, right?
Mm-hmm.
But
or at least somewhere to live. right, not so they own the land, but they have somewhere stable
to live. And then he provided them with food. Then there was a famine. So do we think from this that his brothers, his family kept getting food when the Egyptians did not?
Right. So there's this very, strategic panning of the camera.
Yeah.
Sort of, we have a focus on Yosef and his family and their reunion and everything is great. Yosef. Let's just look at the Egyptians for a while.
Yeah.
The famine's getting worse and worse. They're getting poorer and poorer. And then there's like a brief pan back to the Jews in the very last pasuk, which you can see in the Hebrew and you have to imagine in the English.
Yeah.
Right? Vayesha Yisrael, Beretz Mitzrayim, Beretz Goshen, Vayecha Zuba, Vayifru Veyirbu Me'od. It's like, we had this comment about the land. You might not have noticed that they were like lucky to have land in the first verse. By the time you get to Pasuk 27, and then you hear about the land again, it's not like new information, but it is new information, right? Because there's now a different way like to think about it. Okay, I'm going to take Amy's comment, and then we're going to move on a little bit.
Is that last verse hinting that some of that land that had been taken away from the Egyptians was now being dispensed to this rapidly growing clan?
Well, since it says Eretz Mitzrayim be'Eretz Goshen, that they're still in the land of Goshen, I'm not sure if we're yet at the place where they've actually, you know, spread past their, like, ghetto boundaries. But you could imagine when the pasuk says Vayifru Vayirbu Me'od, but they're getting bigger and bigger and bigger, and they're on this limited amount of land, you could sort of see the elbows, you know, start to, like, push out. Although,
so your assumption is not part of Egypt.
It is part of
Egypt. As opposed to the best part of Egypt.
It's kind of like a section that is annexed by Egypt, but isn't the same, like, I don't know that much about, like, ancient Near Eastern geopolitics and what everything is over there, so somebody else knows better than you can, but I think that Goshen is both part of and not part of Egypt.
And it was Pharaoh.
Like Guam.
It was already Pharaoh's when this started.
It's like Puerto Rico, for better or for worse. Yeah.
And it was already Pharaoh's, so,
yes.
You know, so it didn't have to go through this whole process.
Oh, okay, that's very interesting. Okay, great. Here's what we are going to do now. We're going to go into Ve'eleshemot, and what I want you to do is in Chavruta, to just learn the Pesukim from Shmot and just pay a little bit more attention to maybe some of the echoes of the story from Sefer Bereshit, how you would really read that vav, right? Really read this story as a continuation of the story that we just had. So let's take, it's 2:30 now. Let's come back together at, say, 2:45-ish, so you have, like, about 10 or 15 minutes. Welcome back to Egypt. Okay. I just want to, in case it, like, wasn't obvious and I hadn't, like, already hit you over the head with the connection between the previous parak and this parak, there's two psukim in particular, which are essentially mirror but intensifications of each other. Right, so you have Vayeshev Yisrael, Beretz Mitzrayim, Goshen, blah, 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 Vayifru, Vayirbu, Me'od. And then in the next parak, Ubnei Yisrael, Paru, Vayishritu. Like, they're not only a lot of them, they're swarms of them. Vayirbu, Vayatzmu, Me'od, Bim'od, Me'od. Right, this is the Torah being subtle, but not
subtle.
Like, the only thing about this that's like a little bit subtle is that these two psukim aren't right next to each other. They're six psukim apart. But like, actually, this is insane, right? And it's actually not that common to have this in the Torah, where the Torah is like, remember what I said a couple verses ago? I'm saying it again a little louder. Okay? Yeah. Is your hand up?
Yes, and the last three words. Vatimaleha aretzotam, you talked about elbow room before, like this is, like, especially with Vayishritu, like this is overflow.
And I think that Vatimaleh might be coming to correspond to the Eretz Goshen, right, that they were in the Eretz Goshen, and now they're no longer Eretz Goshen, they are everywhere. You can't walk 5 feet without running into a Jew. They are everywhere, they're taking art. Okay.
Do you think they were not just in Goshen at this point?
Vatimaleh ha'aretz otam suggests that they are everywhere. Everywhere you want to be, there's another Jew. taking your job, charging you taxes. Okay.
So are they growing on just that it's alive, or are they only growing after the test?
So it's a good question, right? What is the significance of this transition from Yosei's death to? It could be just a transition of time, but I think it could also be, when you say why you're blue about a population, it's kind of neutral. There are more of them now, population growth. When you say that they're swarming, that's not neutral, right? And so it might not necessarily be about the numbers that shift so much with the death of Yosef, but it could be about the characterization that shifts a lot with the death of Yosef. These large number of people are now vermin, right? Yeah. With the shift of Yosef, yeah.
It's interesting because it's the Torah speaking, and it sounds like Pharaoh speaking.
Yeah. Good, right? This is not actually in the voice of Paro. This is the voice of the narrator saying, here's the situation, they're everywhere. Good. Yes, Jeff.
Sure. Just going back to that point about the strange translation of you, right? Go back to verse 21. They say, make us avadim. And then with Torah says, this does not say that he v'ya'avidotam, right? Right, it does not make them into slaves, or at least not. Whereas over here, right, precisely what Pharaoh does is it uses that word, right? It says "Vayavidu Mitzrayim etnei Yisrael." Just maybe pointing this out, in a certain sense, that this is a backlash or a reaction, right? The language of the backlash is stronger than the initial measure that perhaps they're responding to.
Good. Right? And I would say that is universal, always the case. You know, when you're away, you nudge me back. Then I nudge you back. Then you nudge me back. Right? That's the way that fights break out. It starts with, like, I accidentally step on your toe, and it ends with, you're pummeling me in the face. That's not just what's happening with the Egyptians and the Israelites. That's what happens whenever somebody else is in somebody else's face. If you ever ridden the subway, things can escalate very quickly. Yes, David.
And also the observation that Howard and I were looking at this, that it didn't seem to, in Shemoto verse 5, was Yosef's name mentioned. So it was Yaakov and his family came down, and then Yosef. Mm-hmm. And then a Pharaoh rose who did not know Yosef was not necessarily bad, because it meant that the people might not have ever known why Yosef had become like Paro. And so it gave him a better platform to go into this program of oppressing everyone that had. Right, that the memory was there, that they didn't exactly know why Yosef was ruling over them. It's a historical memory, but they were able to go and do the suppression over everybody, just in general.
Great, right, and so if you look at the next page, at the very top, I have a little machloket. It's actually from Masechet Sota, but I like to quote Rashi whenever possible. This is my best friend. So Vayakam Melech Hadash, we've got a new king, and the end of that pasuk is Asher Lo Yadat Yosef, and Rav and Shmuel have a disagreement. One of them says it's literally a new king. Yeah, but that's not a new king. Right? What does it mean that he doesn't know Yosef? It's not that he doesn't literally know Yosef. He doesn't recognize Yosef. Right? Now we're moving forward.
Intentional forgetting.
Exactly. Where I used to feel beholden to you, right? There was some level of gratitude that kept my negative emotions in check,
right,
or like shaped my negative emotions. Right? And now it's just like, no. Right? Now this is not Yosef and his brothers. Now this is a people that are a threat. Good. Yes.
Yeah, I was just going to point out on an earlier comment, it's possible, maybe probable, but not necessary to read Vayirbu, Vayatzmu, Paru, Vishurtzu as a negative. I mean, it could just be echoes of the Bereshit language of being of creation, multiplying, first chapter there, first chapter here. I mean, you can read...
You can still read this a little bit neutral.
Well, to the gentleman... his comment, right? Is this God's language or is this Pharaoh's language? Right? This could just be how we describe things in numbers.
Okay, great. Yes, Jeff.
But the contrast between the piece that we read in Bereshit, where you said we saw that there weren't really a lot of emotions expressed. And then in this Shmod piece, they're everywhere. There's all kinds of language.
Good. We have fear, we have disgust.
Mm-hmm.
Good. Right. So
good.
It seems
Oppression. Like Bereshit
is sort of like holding out,
setting
the stage, and Shmod opens up the spigot. Right.
Yeah.
Here's all the emotions, here's the result. Right. And I don't really I don't want to cast this in terms of like blame or justification, but really what I think is going on in the Torah and what I hope is going on in this class is we're just talking about the way people feel about how things played out. It's not necessarily always a question about right or wrong, justified or not justified. Sometimes the question that you have to ask first is, how did we get here? Right? And that's separate from who's at fault, right? And how do we shift the blame onto an individual or individuals? Okay, yes.
So I have to say that I always read this first paragraph of Shmot being incredibly ominous, really ominous.
Yeah.
And now it seems, you know, it's like a different tone. It's there's a kind of tone of irony here. I don't know if it's irony, but I have to say the threat that's pointed out, it's not heretical, but the threat that's pointed out here seems more real. That is to say that. And there is a kind of irony, right? Therefore they said taskmasters, right? The Sar Hamisim. But who had been taskmasters, you know, who became, you know, Sar Hamisim, so to speak?
Right. So the language of Maas is not used in the previous parak,
but
the
it's still implied.
Institution of Maas,
exactly.
Right? Clearly
right. Created. So, not to justify, you know, this, but I have to say that there's the fear of the other,
yeah.
The xenophobia, is attenuated just, attenuated, it's like it's, you understand it a little, given their experience. You now have, if you read this, the 47th paragraph of Bereishit, there's a caste of protected, prosperous outsiders, right, who are in some way, at least their leader, is in some way responsible for, you know, kind of impoverishing the people.
So we're starting to build our list, right, of echoes or things that we notice more in Shmo now that we've read the end of Bereishit. So just to start cataloging them, we have this pasuk, not super subtle. We have the sort of language of emotion that we noticed was missing and now is present. We have the taxes, which is a huge component. We have the language of Vaya Avidu, that they're actually making them into slaves, which even if it isn't quite what happened in Yosef's time, there was still that suggestion that was brought up in Yosef's time. Good. What are the other echoes that we hear? Yes.
Well, not so much an echo, but in Exodus 1, there's this fellow who appears as an actor now by the name of Pharaoh. He's obviously been enjoying the results of Genesis 47 and benefited from them, and he's kind of been hiding behind Joseph or whatever, but certainly not taking any responsibility. And it is whatever's happening is certainly his responsibility.
Good.
Now all of a sudden he's the aggrieved person and saying, gosh, look what's happened. And wants to try and remedy the situation or maybe even make it more to his own advantage.
Right. Part of what's happening in the machloket about is this really a Melech Hadash is this the same king that stood quietly behind while Yosef enriched him, and then when his people were good and pissed off, stepped in front and was like, we gotta get rid of Yosef and these people, right? That, there's one vision of Paro where he's kind of Nebuch, right? It's the same machloket that we have about Achashverosh, is he evil or dumb, right? You can also have that argument about Paro, is he evil or dumb? And part of the machloket between Rav and Shmuel is this a new king or is this an old king? If he's an old king, he's not dumb. He's biding his time and he's strategic. If he's a new king, he doesn't know. He sees these new people, or he has to figure out what to do about it. Like, and the language, or Haba Nitzchak Malo, right, which isn't really embracing Mem Zion, but is part of like Yosef.
Yeah.
Yosef is smart.
Who is described Ishnavon Bakakam?
Yeah. He is the only person thus far who has been described as smart.
Well, that might be why you waited for him to die.
Right, and so, good. Right? But what I want you to notice is that part of Paro deliberately saying, Hava Nitzchak Malo, let's outsmart him, is not coincidental, right? We are going to outsmart him the way that he outsmarted us. It started out as lining my coffers, and now I'm starting to feel like I'm a little bit nervous, right, about how the balance of this power is shifting and how it looks like it might not benefit me forever. And I want to draw your attention to what is the most confusing pasuk, I think, in this passage, the one that's extremely important to pay attention to when we're reading the story in this lens. This pasuk Yud, Hava Nitzchak Malo, let's outsmart it. 10-year bet, maybe it's going to get bigger. And it will be when there is some sort of war. Right? It doesn't really say where the war is coming from. It seems like it's probably coming from inside or outside. Okay, it's coming on the outside. They'll fight with us, and they will go up from the land. He will go up with to the land. Right? If you're paying attention to what is described in plural language and what is described in singular language, the Egyptians are described in plural language, and the Israelites are described as look, as one. Okay? So it seems like there's this amazing dynamic going on in the minds of the Egyptians. I hate these people. There are too many of them, and I am deathly afraid that they are going to leave.
That's ironic.
But I think that we see this dynamic. I mean, at least in Jewish history, we see this dynamic a lot. We want to have some Jews to be moneylenders. We want to have some Jews to run the distilleries. We need to have some Jews, but we need to have not too many Jews, right? And when we see that there's going to be too much power, then we got to dial it back. But we don't want to actually get rid of all of them because we realize that that would be economically disadvantageous, right? And I think that part of what they're recognizing is, yeah, Yosef saved our lives. Like, there's some good use to these people, but also they could become more powerful than us, so we need to channel them. We need to keep them in check. It's not quite that we need to, like, totally get rid of them. Yes?
Just a different twist on the new not Pharaoh, I mean, new not Joseph. I mean, I think I see it as a new king in that way, where it's we miss our opportunity. Because new non-Joseph means we didn't take advantage of getting to know the new leadership.
Mm-hmm.
We didn't develop the relational power that we could have in that moment. And Pharaoh, not knowing Joseph, also meant that he didn't know the smartness of Joseph's ways. And the only way a leader can handle that is to be fear-mongering and demagoguing.
So that's really interesting. You're saying, Lo Yadav Yosef, on the one hand, is an explanation, but it also could have been an opportunity, right, where we actually, there's some amount of blank slate here. We're no longer Yosef of the old Paro, now there's the next generation, and there could have been a shift, but instead we have this move toward demagoguery as opposed to, like, let's all work together and be one nation. It's very interesting. Yes?
Just another read on the Alam in Haaretz. Actually, I thought you were headed here, that it could mean they were going to come up from Goshen and just take over everything else.
Mm-hmm.
And so it's not that piece you're talking about, which I understand, this, like, push and pull, we hate you, we don't want you to leave. But it might be a more shot level of just
like
the
Hisad
and
the
concern
they're
yeah.
gonna spread too much. Great. Yes.
The singular nature when Bnei Yisrael is described versus the plural of Egypt, and the fact that it's not that the generation of Yosef or you know are not known, but it's just Yosef. It's like in Pharaoh's mind they were a singular entity that was insignificant, and now you know, they're not, they've, you know, expanded and they're no longer singular, they're plural, and that's just scary beyond belief.
Good. Okay, here's what I want to do now. I want to give us a 5-minute break. It's exactly 3:00 now. Let's come back together at 3:05 after we've had a drink of water, stretch our legs a little bit, and then we'll go into Zohar HaChaim, will be our next.
That is not where I'm heading. It's only going to get more interesting than that. It's just an hour's worth of setup.
Yeah.
Because if anybody comes to make war on Egypt, they're not going to kill the Egyptians. And
yeah, so there are a lot of the Parshim who read the Allah as referring to Parham, but if you're following the pronouns, it's not Parham.
Okay.
Yeah.
Right, but he's like using, you know, Lashon Segina to,
yeah,
you know.
You're in good company on that. I don't think that's the shot, but you're in better company than me on that.
How about that, Dina?
Is there any criticism
explicitly? You mean like in the? Not that I know of. There's no like, ah, now we see it's for that. I think that like reasonably, nobody wants to say that the Egyptians were just, or like implied that the Egyptians were justified with what they did. And I agree, right? Even if you have this like story and you can see how there is feelings of resentment, that doesn't mean that you should then enslave people or end up being front. So I'm not worried that anybody's going to take the lesson of like, oh, we deserve this, so everything is fine. If I worry about that, yeah.
I'm worried about that. It's more temporary,
right? Yeah. Well, there is, there's a midrash for the 10 martyrs, and they have this, that the way that the king justified killing the 10 martyrs was that the Jews had sold Yosef into slavery and had never paid the price. So there's definitely that history. Okay. Who wants to be my shepherd and bring the flock back? Or should I just have faith that my sheep will find their way home?
No.
I mean, any good shepherd doesn't have faith that their sheep is going to come.
No, they have
a sheep dog. Yeah.
If you go chase a stray, maybe you can lead the people.
Yeah.
Dina's class starting.
How's that, Gina?
You did a great job. I don't know if you're going to do this, but there are a lot of
people. Dina, just start talking and you're going to sit down. How's that, Gina?
That's very good. I like that.
Slavery. Well, it's one of my favorites.
That is, by the way, the best way to clear out my sanctuary.
He's about to escape.
Open the doors.
Because if slavery was bad in itself, there was no need to save the power out here.
Right.
So
that's a We are going to shift ahead in history, just like a couple of centuries, and we're going to look at this text through the eyes of the Or HaChaim, Rabbi Chaim Ibn Attar. I don't know, do we have any Or HaChaim fans that want to say anything about him in the room?
He's awesome.
He's awesome, okay. Why don't you give me like a little more, since you put yourself out there?
Very awesome.
No, I don't really know what you want, but it's like you go to like Muncie now, and you go to the Sephardim stores there, they have him all typed into Yiddish because he's so popular amongst the Hasidic groups because he's so Kabbalistic and he backs up so much of what the Hasidic Rebbeim are basing themselves off of. And he's just like openly quoting Kabbalah left and right, even the Lurianic Kabbalah he has in there. So he's probably of all the Mepharshim that are in like that red Maor. And he's one of the five rabbis named HaKadosh, which is pretty cool.
Yes. So that's right. So the Or HaChaim HaKadosh, he's a very good spot. So he's one of the HaKadoshes. I wouldn't necessarily go left and right with his quoting of Kabbalah, but it's definitely open. Right? So when he quotes it, he's open about it. One way that I like to think about his popularity, sort of, now his popularity is more Hasidically sort of restricted. But when you think about the Mekor Gedolot that was first published, right? The principle is we want to make money, so we are going to publish what is most popular. And the Or HaChaim was like, had just finished his commentary, and then the first Mekor Gedolot publishes him. Like, that's how popular he is. I will tell you why I loved Or HaChaim. I think the Or HaChaim is extremely psychologically perceptive. He also, like, has a very high tolerance for noticing detail. So often his comments are extremely long. So if you're just looking at the Mekor Gedolot and you're like, oh, Rashi, there's three lines of his commentary. The Or HaChaim, you're like, oh, it's another page of the Or HaChaim. He's still talking. So he's very verbose. But it's really because he has to account for every little thing. My favorite aspect of the Or HaChaim, which I probably using the term favorite sarcastically, is that every time it says Lamor, he's got a thing for it. And it's not always the same explanation. He has a different explanation for every time it says Lamor. He says Lamor a lot. He always has a thing. So that's sort of like the level of attention to detail that we're talking about here. Okay. So when we're looking in our Pesukim and Shvot, I just want us to start noticing, right, all of the moments that are redundant and are unnecessary that the Or HaChaim is going to have an opportunity to pick up. So the first thing that we're going to do is just go with the Or HaChaim, sort of set up all of his questions, and then we're going to walk through with him as he knocks them down in a way that is just like extremely powerful and very beautiful, and also, to be honest, like a little scary. Okay. Ve'od. So we're on page 3. When it says Ve'od, you know that the Or HaChaim has already been talking about this pasuk for many paragraphs, but he still has more. Okay. Ve'yachad Malach Hadash, there's a new king. Okay. V'hinei lefi pashtan shel dvarim, where the straightforward reading says, ki kol od shehaya echad mehador haku kayam, as long as there was one member of the previous generation who was alive, Hayamoneya Hashiabu, that would have been enough for there to be no slavery.
How is that shot?
Good. How is that shot? I like that question. It's pshat in that when you continue on, you'll realize that what really bothers him is that there's extra phrases in the pasuk that talks about the death of Yosef and the death of his brothers and the death of his generation. So he's assuming that the Torah, why does the Torah tell you that Yosef and his entire family died? It's because there's something about the death of these people that enables the Shiabu to happen. He takes that for granted. What he finds annoying is if you look, so let's go back. If you look back to Pasuk 1, we've got all the names. Who cares? Then we've got the total number of people. Okay. Now Pasuk 6. Then Yosef died. And all his brothers. And that whole generation, right? So Pasuk 5. If I believe that the Torah always uses the most concise way of relaying information, if the entire generation is dead, that includes Yosef's brothers, and that includes Yosef himself. So the Or HaChaim is like, I know that there's something significant about the shift in the generations, but what I'm upset about, what I'm lamoring about, right, is that it's given to me in stages that don't appear to be necessary for the pshat goal of I'm shifting the canon. But you're right that you could say this is not the pshat. But he doesn't
see that as not the pshat.
He doesn't see that as not
the problem
pshat.
In the text, that's pshat. What I'm going to tell you is the case is the pshat.
Correct.
Okay.
You don't got to love it, but you will love it by the end. I promise you will love it by the end. Okay. So, right, if a significant shift that enables, right, the attitude to change in Egypt is the death of the entire generation, then it should have just said, they all died. Okay? This is difficult. For if it were so, then it would have been sufficient for the verse to say, the whole generation died by Yamat Kol HaDor HaHu. For if only one member of the generation were alive, there would have been no enslavement. So I don't like that there are so many details here. So that's question number one. Why details in death of Joseph's generation? Okay. Trust me, there are many questions. Okay. So it did not have to speak of Yosef's death, nor the death of his brothers, because obviously there would be no that should say enslavement while they themselves were still alive. So he's going to answer his first question. And maybe the verse intends to indicate the following, and this is actually something that we were talking about, that there were stages in the matter of enslavement. For when Yosef died, they lost some of their sex. For at the beginning, they were more elevated than the Egyptians, but then became equal to them. And with the death of the brothers, they were demoted again, and were beneath the Egyptians, who sneered at them, but didn't enslave them. And with the death of the entire generation, they began to enslave them due to their jealousy when they saw the growth of Israel and the way that Egypt was filled with them. Okay, the Or HaChaim never explicitly says, I'm reading this whole thing through the lens of Bereishit Mem Zayin, but he is, right? And when you hear him talk about these stages, right, we who have just read Bereishit Mem Zayin know all about stages, right? Know that stages is what caused the Egyptians, well not caused, stages is the way the Egyptians themselves became enslaved. So surprise, surprise, stages is also going to be the manner in which the Jews become enslaved. Okay. And now we're moving on. Vayasimu alav sarei nisim. Okay, I want us to flip back to page 2, get a little exercise here.
Little.
Just a little. And I just want us to reread through these psukim so that we're sensitized to the language that the Or HaChaim is going to pick through. So we're at pasuk 10. Hava nitzchak malo, let's outsmart him. Ken yirbeh, maybe he's going to get bigger. Vayakin tekrat mahala, maybe there's going to be war. Benosaf hamu asodinu, benacham banu ba'alam in ha'aretz. Okay, that's the concern. Vayasimu alav sarei nisim, so they placed upon him, that is the Jewish people, these officers of taxation, leman anoto besivota, in order to oppress him with their burdens. Okay, the Or HaChaim thinks that this pasuk is redundant. Why is it redundant? If I, God forbid, I wouldn't use you as an example. Okay, but I just mean this in the gentlest of way. If it's narrated that Dina punched, God forbid, Zach in the face, you would not need to then narrate in order to hurt him. Okay? So there seems to be like an extra explanation here, which is what Guido pointed out, that it's not only that they're causing them to suffer, they're causing them to suffer in order to make them suffer. Right? There's something extra here. Okay, so that's the first piece that I want you to pay attention to. And then I want you to skip down to Pasuk Yud Gimel, by Avidu Mitzrayim et Bnei Yisrael b'Farech. The Egyptians enslaved Israelites with Farech, whatever that means. And then again, in the next Pasuk, if you go to the end, it says b'Farech. It says b'Farech twice, which is significant, both because clearly they want you to pay attention to that word, and also because this is a very interesting word. How do you translate parach? Nobody really knows. We've got backbreaking, we've got ruthless, or I think NRSV says ruthless. So there's a machloket in the Gemara, in Sota. One way to read it is pricha, which means to like crush or to crumble. That's where we get the translation that I usually use of backbreaking labor. But another thing that the Talmud loves to do when it encounters a word that it doesn't understand is bring them into smaller words that it does understand. Okay, right? That's a process of notar rikon. So if I just separate the pay from the resh, I've got pay. If you write it out, that's peh. Okay, one word I understand, mouth, good. And then ra, another word I understand, soft. Okay, so there is gentle speech. So the Or HaChaim knows that there's this machloket in the Gemara. He paskins, right? He decides that the obvious explanation is para. And we are going to see him actually bring that up. How are we doing with our questions? Also, we have the question of why does it need to say in order to... in order to afflict.
Yep. To impose taxes on a people and to impose labor on them don't seem obviously the same to me. It seems like there are two different acts happening at first.
Good. Wait.
Yeah. The pricha and parakwet, you said sota, I think, you know, where? Or is it?
Sota, yud aleph. So you see the Rashi quoted Sota Yud Aleph. If you continue on to Amud Bet, at the very top of Amud Bet is the Machloket. And here I actually looked it up. This is Rabbi Eliezer, for those of you who are so from that you need to know. And this is Rava.
11B.
Okay. Let's continue through this in Or HaChaim. I think we have enough background. Okay. I love this moment so much. We're at the bold, by Asu Alam Sarei Nisim. We go, Kan HaBen Shoel. Here the child asks. Okay, he's getting into the Pesach spirit, right? And he's imagining this kid is like, wait a minute. Something doesn't add up. And what doesn't add up? Ma chachma nitchachmu b'adam. What is so smart about this? This isn't cleverness, just evil and brazenness. Right, so the Paro's like, I'm gonna come up with a brilliant plan. And you look at the pasuk and you're like, that just seems like an aggressive plan, right? I'm not impressed. But it's very strategic to just go and slave a people. Okay, so that's his first question here. Like, this is not smart. I'm just going to put on the board as smart does not equal mean, or mean does not equal smart. Okay. Further. Right, and now we have another question, which is really about, well, let's just look at the lay of the land. How did they even conceive of placing tax officers at the beginning of the enslavement? Like, why is the tax officers a thing? Also, how could Israel accept upon themselves to do strange work with clay and bricks? You are the family of the last leader. You are living in this like glassy area. You got all your sheep. Right? And somebody's like, you're my slave now. You know what you do? You laugh at them. You say, get off my property before I release the hounds. Right? How did it happen that the Jews are like, oh, you want us to be your slaves? Okay. We're the ones with all the money. money and all the power, but we're very happy to work for you for free. Right? There has to be something that went on to get them from point A to point Z. There needs to be a process. Okay. And behold, our sages said that the matter was gradual. Right? He says, but I also have this teaching. What is perach? What does gentle speech imply? It implies that we didn't come to you with aggressive weapons. We came to you first with, let's talk this out. I want to talk to you. I just want to have a conversation.
Okay.
And so now he's going to go through and explain how all of this comes together.
I just want to make sure that we have this. So they seem... Where is that? Okay.
According to the words of our sages, it must be said that there were words that preceded the placing of the tax offices. And according to what I explained in the verse that states, more numerous and more powerful than we, rather than assuming men, that they thought that they could enslave them on the basis of the good that they had done to them during the years of famine. They could have come upon them immediately and by force enslaved them and placed officers on them, and then they would have been a lower status vis-a-vis the Egyptians and would have submitted. Right, so the first way that he's imagining this is the conversation is, you guys kind of owe us, right? Maybe we could sort of talk you into a work swap. So when the conversation first begins, the Egyptians come with the attitude of, you know, we've spent a lot of time being grateful to you. Now it might make sense for you to start thinking about the ways in which you're grateful to us, because it's our land, right, that you've been squatting on, and it's our benevolence, right, that allowed you to stay here. Okay. So when the verse says, let us outsmart, it can't be about the enslavement, but rather on a different detail. He's like, I'm still stuck on this Havani Karmala. Why is this so smart? Okay. I hate to say it, but he's still pulling, piling on the questions. It appears further that when it says to oppress them, that this was unnecessary, for it is evident that they intended to impress them. Further, and what does this Siflo Tom come to include? Okay, we're doing great. Come to exclude. Therefore, finally we're at a therefore. He's going to give you the answer to his many questions. I promise you it's worth it. It appears that they outsmarted them in enslaving them in this manner. For Paro presumably had other builders from among the Egyptians or other people to construct residential cities and other laborers to do the other work that the kingdom requires. You know what Paro doesn't need? Slaves. He's got a lot of workers. Right? So it can't be that until the Jews were enslaved, there was nobody to do capital works projects in Egypt. That this is how it all started. There was nobody to build the cities. What are you talking about? Of course there were workers who were building the city. Those people are already in place. And these people, here's where it gets brilliant, are called mas. These people are called tax. Because when Shlomo HaMelech levied a tax on the Jewish people, what he was asking for was people, laborers. So now a mas is not money. A mas is a laborer. And what is the sar of a laborer? The boss, the manager, okay? And he hatched a plan, that is, Paro hatched a plan, to task Israel that they would be the tax officers, meaning that they would be the ones who are in charge of all who do the king's labor. And this would not be a diminishing or lowering of the status of Israel, and they can't refuse it, right? Paro says, do you want to be the boss? I've got all these laborers. You guys are so smart. You're Yosef's progeny. Like, you guys are clearly, I see the sparks of leadership in you. You should really be the ones who are in charge of this project. Jews, yes, I am really smart. I am very capable. Yes, I do make a good leader. And it's an offer they cannot refuse. But their attentiveness, when Paro makes the Jews the boss, it's not obvious that it's Leman Anotov Sivotam. So the Torah needs to say, it looks like Paro is giving them a promotion. It's not going to be good at the end, right? So the narration has to say to us, this is Leman Anotov Sivotam. And how is it going to happen? That is, and their intended this is for trickery in order to oppress the people of Israel with the burdens of the taxes. and who are the taxes? The ones who do the labor. That when they can't do all of the work that is upon them, given that it exceeds what they can carry, the officers themselves will need to join with them to do the work and fill the quota. So you start out as the boss, but you're like, I need to get this project done. I don't have enough laborers. I guess I'm going to end up doing the work myself. Okay. For the only ones who know the work requirements are the officers, who are the Israelites who are in charge. Right? They're the ones that have the plans. They're the ones that know what goes into it. They're doing the math, and they're like, I have 50 hours worth of labor that needs to get done. I only have 40 hours worth of labor manpower. I guess I'm going to be making up that extra 10 hours. Let's just send it in. Okay? Right, and you can see what's going to eventually happen. The Jews were in charge. Then they join in with the workforce. And then slowly but surely, all the Egyptians go home, and who's left? Just this enslaved people, right? Who enslaved themselves. Okay, and this is their cleverness. That through this trickery, they brought them to the burdens. And this is what our sages meant when they said, Terach. It was gentle speech. They were officers, and then they were laborers. And then Vayi ben Aray. I think that probably everybody in this room sees how this might apply to you. I'm just going to spell it out a little bit. It is the case that often people who are very capable find themselves in leadership positions where they are often dealing with people who they either rightly or not rightly assume are less capable or less responsible. And you start out as the manager that's only supposed to spend an hour of your week just checking in with folks. And then you find out that they're not doing a good enough job. And so then you're like, I'll just do it myself. And then at some point you're like, wait, am I the religious committee? How did that happen? How did I end up doing all of the work that was supposed to be spread out through my entire congregation? Okay. And I think that, like, on the one hand, he does give you this sort of narrative that tells you how it happens in Egypt. We're still in Egypt. But I think that there's also here, like, a little bit of a strategy that he gives you to kind of get out of it. Right? The first hint that he gives you is that it's only the officers who know what the quota is. Right? That there's some disjunct between what the management knows and what the laborers know. And so one suggestion, right, the Or HaFayim is not explicitly making, is try to, like, sort of build into the people who are working for you or underneath you or with you, give them that sense of responsibility, right? Give them the sense of what is going to happen if you don't do this work. Before you join the committee, let me tell you how many hours of work this is going to take. Are you willing to take this on? And only if they say yes, right? And keep them appraised of why this matters and how much work it is actually going to take to get it done. That is, I think, sort of one level of what the Or HaFayim is maybe suggesting. And I think that sort of the second piece, which is much harder for people who are in charge or managers to do, and type A people, all of us, have difficulty saying is, actually, what Paro did was he constructed a system where there was more work to be done than there were people who were capable to do it. And the real job of the Sar HaPisim is to go to Paro and say, I did the math, there's too much labor here, what can we cut out? Right? And when we look at there's not enough people to do the work and there's too much work, instead of saying, I'm going to diminish the work, we're always like, well, I'll just increase the people by doing everything myself, right? And what the Or HaFayim is subtly suggesting is the way out of that is to recognize that there might actually be an objective disparity between what has to be done and who can do it, is actually, like, face that head on and say, I'm actually going to adjust instead of just trying to do everything myself. Those are my two management takeaways, curious about personal or other reflections, Joe, and then.
I think that, like, the reality underlying this is tax market. Right? This is actually how it would work, is that the king would get the Jews to raise the taxes. But he didn't really care how they raised the people. So your quota is such and such, and you had to come up with it, which was like, win-win. Either the Jews would so terrorize the population into giving them either labor or things that they would build up resentment directly to Jews, or they had to make up the shortfall themselves from their own resources. Right? So, I mean, there is, it's interesting, it feels like the Or HaChaim is really working from Jewish lived historical experience and reading it back into the story.
Right. He's also not reading that far, he's also reading a little bit further into the story of Shemot, where part of Paro's strategy, when Moshe and Aaron are like, let's go, he's like, I got a better idea. Why don't I take away some of your raw materials and keep your quota of how much you need to work? Right? So when the Or HaChaim is like looking for where is Paro applying this kind of strategy, he just looks a couple of chapters ahead and is like, I know what Paro does. He makes the task like just too incredible. So I think you're right, it happens like in the recent past as far as Or HaChaim is concerned, but also goes all the way back to the text of the time. Yeah.
My takeaway before we get to the management thing is the more simple idea of enslavement. There's a gradualism to it, right? That one may be misled to think by Yaakov Melech Hadash, and all of a sudden we're slaves. But whether it's Joseph, what we were looking at, or Yaakov in the house of Laban, or the Israelites being enslaved, it actually happens step by step, psychologically, that whatever we are, right, inevitably it doesn't just happen overnight. It's that we wake up and we say, how did we get here? How did I get here? And I think that's just a very powerful aspect, personally, communally, and otherwise.
Yeah, definitely. Yes. Another layer I assume that I don't think really goes deeply into is we've now set the minority over the majority, and they don't like, I meant, because you're saying like the workload, like they can just be like, oh, well now you're in charge and we can just go home. And that there might very much be a cultural, racial power dynamic at play there, in that they're saying, well, I don't want, and I wrote like sort of insert minority here. Like, I don't want insert minority or traditionally less powerful group to be my boss. And we've seen, again, very recently, how people reacted to have somebody who doesn't fit their profile, who should be the leader. And actually, now it's happening both ways, but people reacted very strongly to the idea of having insert minority here into in power. They did not want to be ruled by someone that they think should be.
Good. And I think that what you're also highlighting for us is that Paro's strategy is really in two ways. One is that the Jews are lulled into it when there's this gradualness. It starts out as a promotion. They don't realize that actually they're going to be in the office until 2 a.m. But also, it's set up, it's structured in such a way that it also increases the resentment of the Egyptians. That now these Jews are like, actually their bosses, where do these bosses come from, right? So there's both the element of like from the Jewish perspective, they've got all this work that they can't handle and they're going to have to do it themselves, and that's sort of like one lesson. The other way is in which the Paro is manipulating, right, these human dynamics by making this minority in charge in a way that would increase what is already sort of underneath the surface resentment, is bringing it right up. Right, to the point where you could actually say to, if you think that the Yaldot, right, are not Jewish, right, you could actually, like, where did Paro get in his head that he could ask midwives to kill babies? That's not their business. Right? But he already knew that he had fomented so much resentment that he could do that. Mm-hmm. Yes, yes.
Again, come back to that original thing that was so wonderful, kid saying, what's so smart about this?
Yeah.
Like, where's the cough pump, right? And it's interesting, there's two more, but a sort of run-of-the-mill authoritarian state just presses people, right? There's just like oppression. But maybe what he's anticipating here is a much more insidious, the classic distinction authoritarian versus totalitarian state, right? That pretty much more insidious, where the state gets the people one way or another to kind of impress themselves almost. They're mobilized, and the gradual thing I think is key. So there's, I need to think it out more, but I think that there's something very sharp about what is involved in a truly wicked, kind of, you know, the smart, kind of, in air quotes, right? Regime.
Right. Strategic.
Right, exactly.
Yes.
Strategic is better.
Yes.
Like they have a plan, right?
Okay. I am sorry, but. Because I love where he went, but I don't get how he can do it. Because it never, where in the text itself does it say that the Jews became taskmasters?
So he's reading Vayasimu Alehem Sarevisim as he placed on the Egyptian laborers the Jews as the heads of the mosque, which he, I think, actually very strongly is reading as people
who
do construction projects based on their reading in
He's switching the pronouns in
Yes. What's challenging is it's extremely creative. So you love that it's extremely creative, and then you're also like a little suspicious of it.
Because you have to then make a big leap to the whole rest of the section.
Right. But I think it's also important that Orhan Pyam has both, he wants to account for all of their redundancies, which he does, and he wants to like apply some psychological message. The shot in the middle of like what the text is actually saying, much less interesting than that, right? He wants to account for all the questions, he wants to say something profound, he does both of those things, and then when you're like, but I just read the Supreme, that isn't what happened, he's like, you have nothing to say to me because I answered every single one of these questions. But yes, I'm with you, guys. Behave.
Yes, I'm just wondering if you think he has sort of an agenda to put agency back into the hands of the Israelites, that they somehow, even though they were tricked, they chose this for themselves and they're active in the story.
I don't think he has an agenda vis-a-vis the past. I think he has an agenda vis-a-vis the present. Right, that he wants you to be alert to this possibility in the future, not that he actually wants to say anything sort of either negative, how people get how dumb you were, or positive, how much agency you had. I don't really see that as being his. Yeah. Sort of going in common order. Not speaking well. Yeah.
Just to comment on the jump meeting of the principles.
Yeah.
This is an instance of blaming the victim. Blaming the victim for his or her own situation.
Yep.
I want to think about this some more, but there's an interesting, a fascinating read, but it's also a disturbing read, I think, if you follow this through.
I agree that it's highly disturbing, and I also, one of the reasons why I kept on trying to shift us away from blame and towards accounting, but I think that really what he's trying to do is explain. But you're right that you can push it a little bit further and say, like, wait a minute, right? You're taking the victims and you're saying that the way that they got there was they just couldn't turn down a promotion, right? I can see why you might read that as a little blaming. It's true. Yes.
It was also a sheep to the slaughter. Like, it's on the same continuum as sheep to the slaughter. Like, they just went along with this plan that was ultimately going to destroy them.
Two things. One is, I wondered, was it significant that he kind of refers to the resentment that we know from Kings against Solomon and the poor day labor, and sort of sides against Solomon in a certain way? And then Rabbi Shufield, we're the only one. I think everybody works for the tech companies, we're totally identified with this. You're so bright, you're so wonderful, you want to work for us, and now you're working 70 hours.
Yeah. I have never taught this to an audience where people have not nodded. This is me.
Yeah.
People who are really involved in Hillel, people who have high-powered tech jobs, lawyers, part of what's fascinating is, why do we all feel like this? We're the people that aren't doing the job and that we're covering for. Yeah, anyway.
This may be a question for historians,
Was he speaking to the people of his time in Morocco? Was there something specific going on then? He was working right against. I don't know.
He generally is not, right, he's generally not like a preacher type. He's more of a psychological insight type. I'm sort of pushing him to like towards a lesson that he is not explicitly going. So I think it's very unlikely that he's trying to teach a particular lesson, even though, you know, I could obviously see it. Yeah, and that kind of thing.
This is also paralleling the Yosef story, where Yosef is also given a fortune, except he's using his divine given spirit in order to live out God's plan for saving the Egyptian man and Jewish people. And you know, I guess this is the Israelites feeling like they're so important that they can continue to use their innate skill instead of using
them. Yeah. Rough.
That was exactly my comment. That it's interesting that it comes, like, Yosef has to die in order for this to happen because Pharaoh places them in the role of Joseph, but they're not as smart as Joseph.
Ouch.
But Joseph has gone on and has to be both get very, very long, so it's true.
Going back to the idea that this is the same king who couldn't figure out this divinely inspired reason Joseph did it, maybe the question 0.5 would be, what made this pharaoh think that he could actually put a plan like this in to manipulate the descendants of Joseph and be successful at it? Just taking it that much further, because clearly he couldn't, his own court, the people who were down in the dungeon with him couldn't interpret their own dreams. That's how he got them, was serendipitous how that all happened. And then the baby.
Was it the hand of God?
Or was it the hand of God, of course. Sorry, it was the hand of God. And then, you know, and in any event, so the idea is if it's the same Pharaoh, I would just add what made him turn into someone who was so psychologically manipulative, and maybe he recognized it himself that putting Joseph in that position was actually a failure of his previous leadership, and then he needed to turn into a megalomaniac to...
So he sort of feels responsible.
You know, who knows? I mean, obviously, Joseph actually, through the hand of God, manipulated his way, or made the way, made it happen for him to get elevated to be like Kamo Pharaoh, right?
Yeah.
And so, but maybe after he was gone, if it's the same Pharaoh, he's thinking to himself, wow, I let that happen to me, and now look at what's happening to us. Just a grin.
So one of the things we're talking about is you unleash a force, and then it bounces back, and there's pushback. So you had said, Egyptians said, you kind of owe it to us, because you had a good time. So then they become the slaves, and there's a whole tone during the darkness plague, you kind of owe it to us, so we take your money because we work for you. So it's like back and forth.
Right. Yes. Yeah. I think the more that you read these stories, the more you see kind of echoes in a way that I think feels both satisfying and also very destabilizing. Like, are we ever going to escape from this? That's not it. Yes.
So another echo that the story is small task, but the story for a sheet. The idea of Ramses. And I think it reinforces what you're saying, because the Jews were thinking they were working for themselves, because they were building their own cities.
Oh, beautiful.
Ramses is where they live.
Ah. Right, so what Guido was noticing is that it says the Jews live in Ramses, but the cities that they build are Pithom and Ramses, so it seems like they're enriching themselves, or they're being in charge of maybe the construction projects in their own neighborhood, so that makes them more invested and also less aware. Yeah, great. I brought you a present.
Was
it wasn't in the original.
This was already a great gift.
Okay. This is gonna be good. So I have never had 2 hours to teach this year before. So it was great. I loved having time for everybody's comments, but I'm excited to also have time to do what I think is the flip side, which is not to imagine the story from the perspective of the Egyptians, but to really get into it from the perspective of the Israelites. So some of you, probably many of you, have heard of the P.S.S. Nerebi. He is probably most famous for his work, the Eish Kodesh, when he was delivering sermons in the Warsaw Ghetto, and he buried them, and they were actually found, which is in itself a miracle. But he also has like an entirely separate life as a master educator. And he wrote this three-part series about education. It starts on the sort of elementary level of Chobad HaTalmidim, the student's obligation, which is basically for elementary school children. And then the next step in your pedagogical journey is to be an avrich, to be like an older yeshiva bachur. You're probably away from home. Right now you sort of have like a, you're taking more control over your own education. And then the last step is b'nei machshava tova, which is, has a lot of like meditation practices, and is really when you sort of graduated from high school, but you're in these small chaburot that are involved in, you know, spiritually reinforcing practices. That's b'nei machshava tova. That book got very popular because mindfulness is very popular. And so people often skip over the Chobad HaTalmidim, which I think is like one of the most amazing books probably ever written. And he writes like very sweet, very easy to understand, very engaging Hebrew. Recommended. It's also translated, but recommended in the Hebrew. If you have even like pretty good Hebrew, you'll be able to make your way through it. Neglected, I think for good reason, is Hashar HaFer in the middle. It's very hard. Like what he thinks a like high school student is supposed to be doing, I don't get it. It's very, very, very demanding. But this is how far I am in. One of the incredibly moving and also incredibly possible sections of the book is in chapter 6 and 7. He talks about using your imagination. Like when you're reading the Midrash, like really imagine yourself in the Midrash, right? When you are like davening before Hashem, like really try to picture what's happening and sort of to use your imaginative faculty to like expand your spiritual experience. And I think that also like part of what happened in the story, the way that the Aruch Haim tells it, is that there was some lack of imagination. People couldn't actually see what was going to happen in the future. They weren't able to look beyond, right, what they were being given right now, which was a promotion. And so in the Hafshar HaBifin, he says that you should like really, really imagine what's happening in the future. You really get into it. And then he says you can also do a harhava, where it's basically fan fiction, right? Really try to imagine what was happening there and sort of tell the story yourself. Like really get into it. And he has pages and pages and pages and pages and pages about the Exodus. And when I was reading this with my Chavruta before we gave up on this, for the reasons that I stated, I was just reading through the story the way that he tells it, and she's just crying. Like, it just, the way that he tells it, so beautiful and so moving. And I just wanted to end with a little bit of his telling of the story. And I think that when you read it, you will have to see, let's do more positives than negatives, you will have to see the ways in which his approach is like the exact mirror of what's happening to Aruch HaChaim. You could tell the same story with the same dynamics, reading it entirely from the lens of the victim, right? And read it entirely as this is what happened to us. And I think the real challenge is to be able to hold both of these narratives at the same time. So we are the privileged few that are going to be able to hear this narrative. Does everybody have one of these? I translated this during lunch when I realized I had more time. So I hope that it is in English. Okay. When you learn Tanakh, you should try to participate in all of the holy happenings that occurred as if you were also there. You should participate in the journey of Abraham, our father, and Yitzchak to the Akedah. In the pain of Yaakov, our father, when he prayed to God, save me now from the hand of my brother, the hand of Esau, for I fear him. And similarly, when you learn Midrash, for there are many Midrashim on the verses of the Tanakh that reveal more of what the happenings were then. But now you should proceed to a renewed thought process in order to expand and extend that which has been given to you. Even if you do not know that it was truly the way that you imagine it in your mind, for are you not thinking along the lines of what has been said in the Torah and the Midrash? Only you are also expanding your thoughts through that. But he says, don't worry that you're not interpreting correctly. You're imagining. And what you're doing is just another form of legitimate midrash, really getting into what you assume must be happening. And they embittered their lives with hard work. Right? Everything they did was befarek. It was backbreaking. The evil Egyptians did not need those buildings. They only did it in order to afflict Israel. And what they wanted to do was to embitter their lives. And it was for this purpose alone that they made up that they should build Pithom and Ramses. And it wasn't just in the building of Pithom and Ramses, but they researched all kinds of hard labor with which they then enslaved Israel to do. And he's channeling Midrashim. And the life of an Israelite was more worthless to them than the lives of any animal. Not only in that they sent them to dangerous places, like to capture bears and lions, but even within Egypt, they were worthless. Any crazy and evil Egyptian, any lowly teenager, would have the gall to curse or even strike an elderly and distinguished Israelite with horrible blows until his bones would break, even to the point of killing him. Even if the Israelite was stronger than him, he would have to suffer the blows of any disgusting teen, because who would dare stand up to an Egyptian who had the power to, God forbid, kill them all instantaneously? And who among the Israelites would not be broken and shattered, both hands and legs or his other bones? The heavy work itself, which they piled on each person more than he could bear, broke them. And the blows that they would strike them would break them even further, covering them with bruises and wounds until they became repulsive. Right? He's creating this. Why are the Jews becoming repulsive? Because they have wounds and scars that are bleeding and pussy, that they actually, the Egyptians make them disgusting through their mistreatment. They, that is the Israelites, perceived from their parents and their grandparents that they were not lowly slaves from the womb or from birth, that any Egyptian child could yell at them. They were viceroys and free men when they came here. And even the officers and kings of the Egyptians were proud of them. And Yosef, their ancestor, was second in command to the king, who killed all of Egypt from death and destruction. But there is no memory of Yosef or the other elders who had dealt so kindly with the Egyptians. And they just took it upon themselves to oppress Israel, to crush them. The Egyptians didn't remember the greatness of Israel, that they were the children of kings. And even Israel, from the greatness of their distress, forgot themselves and their noble spirit, and they became slaves, broken. So the story continues. Just wanted to give a little bit of that other perspective.
Thanks for listening. To learn more with Hadar, please visit hadar.org/Torah.